introduce Ben. Derek invited up from Santa Barbara, and we're glad to hear. Thanks, Ben.
Hi, my name is Ben. I'm an alcoholic. Thanks for having me up here. It's always good to speak at an AA meeting. I never really know exactly what I'm going to say, how it's going to come out, because there's just so much. You know, when you think about the past and about how everything happened, it's really surreal when I really think back in an honest way about my journey. Sometimes in AA, I can get into a kind of a regurgitation mode where I've said things enough that I kind of just say them and I don't really think back about what it was like, you know? And I do my best not to do that, to really get back into the past. But AA's been a crazy thing that I fought for a long time. You know, step one was not an easy step for me to take. I went to my first AA meeting when I was 20. Gosh, was I 22? I was 22 when I went to my first AA meeting. I'm 35 now. My sobriety date is February 14th of 2006. So I'm in my eighth year now. And I got sober when I was 27 this time. And like Stan said, I really like Stan Scherer, by the way. He's like a preacher, man. Missed his calling. He's good. Good message. And I thought I recognized Dan from Men Without Legs in Santa Barbara. But for me, you know, ego and pride and fear and all these things blocked me from doing step one. I couldn't see myself doing step one. I was too young, you know what I mean? And those were really my years to drink, I felt. And drinking was really working for me when I was 18, 19, 20, you know, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20. And it was, you know, what does the big book say? Like, it took an exciting and exhilarating part of my life. I loved it. I mean, it didn't just do like a little bit for me. It did so much for me. You know, I can remember drinking in high school and just feeling like, I mean, but really in my, you know, 17, 18, 19 is where I really got a taste for it, where I knew what to expect, I knew how much to take, I knew how invincible I felt when I was drinking, and nothing really bad was happening yet. So those were kind of my glory days of drinking, and I just felt like the sexiest guy in the room after I had about six drinks, you know? I just felt like I couldn't say anything wrong. Everything that was just like honey, you know, when I spoke, and all my fears just kind of dropped away, and I could do whatever I wanted to do. It felt like, you know, I'm sure it wasn't that charismatic, but but in my memory, I was. And it worked. I mean, I loved it. And my friends drank too. The red flags weren't really up in the air, you know, when I was that age. And I had my first drink when I was like 14, 15, but you know, I come from a good family up north, and they kind of watched me. There is some alcoholism, not in my immediate family, but my grandfather's, both my grandfathers died of alcoholism early, when they were in their early 50s. And I have a couple aunts and uncles that are meth addict. One was a meth addict, and I haven't seen her for a long time. She's off in Vegas somewhere. I don't even know. And then my uncle's a heroin addict, and he died. But we weren't really out of the closet in my family, you know, as far as addiction went. You know, substance abuse stuff, it wasn't like, I didn't know why, what was going on with my aunt. You know, she's an addict. She was a meth addict running around in Vegas, but I didn't know that. I just knew I hadn't heard from her in a long time. It was very hush-hush. And my grandfathers that I never met, I see pictures of them holding me and stuff, but I don't remember them. They were daily drinkers, hard alcohol, couldn't support the family, you know, really put my grandmothers in a horrible position because of alcohol. And I didn't know that. Not until I started having drinking problems. Oh, yeah, you know, it started to come out that this was kind of a family thing. But I played I played sports a lot. I played soccer at San Jose State up in the Bay Area. And that was like, you know, that I really played soccer like an alcoholic, you know, like growing up. I just played it all the time. And I was really pre-wired for addiction. Anything that felt good, I just wanted to do. I just wanted to keep doing it. I wanted to do it and just wring out every ounce of pleasure out of it and then throw it away, you know, and then wait you know, wait until it felt good again. But that was anything. And I fully got the bug with sports, and it was a huge part of my identity. And so when I went to college, it was like exciting. I was ready to go, and I missed my family. I appreciated them more, I guess, when I left. But the freedom was heaven. You know, I got my dorm room. There's, 30,000 people, half of them are girls, so I was really happy about that. Sorry, Dave. I'm married to this beautiful girl now, so I score. I got really lucky. I got her on lockdown, so she's mine forever. Yeah. And we're pregnant. We got a little baby in there, so yeah, 5 months pregnant, and with our first little baby girl, so I'm really happy. But getting off to school, alcohol was like, I had ultimate freedom, and I drank hard. I blacked out kind of a lot. I like to be right on that edge of really, really drunk, but still having fun, And then it's hard to stay on that line, It's hard to be right on that line of hammered and still able to remember and not, do anything stupid. But that's always what I tried to do. I didn't want 6 beers. That wasn't enough. And if I had 18, probably going to have a little problem. So I tried to balance it. And it went wrong a lot. But that was kind of funny in college, And I'm an addiction counselor at Santa Barbara City College. So I see a lot of younger guys and girls, but I really identify with the young males who are trying to do what I did when I was that age. And I try to be of service to them. But I had an injury when I was 19 that blew my knee out. We were playing a game against Sacramento State, and it just destroyed my knee. And I ended up, that was the end of my soccer career, and really the beginning of my drug and alcohol career. I mean, I had partied with it before, and it had always been a social thing. I'd smoke weed a little bit on my own, but for 99% of it was social. It was almost always with someone else. Even when I drank intensely, it was always with someone else. And when that injury happened, it became like a coping strategy. I think because alcohol and drugs work so well, not just for physical pain, like Oxycontin and Vicodins and opiates work really well for physical pain, but they work so well for emotional pain, And I started to have this identity crisis and a ton of physical pain, and here's 180 extra strength Vicodin with all the refills I could handle, and 4 knee surgeries, and I don't know. I just thought I had so much wrapped up in this sports thing. I hadn't really thought about, do you want to be a lawyer? Do you want to be a businessman? Do you want to be a father? Do you want to, be a therapist? What do you want to be with your life? I was in my brain going to be in the World Cup, which was not going to happen, by the way. Wasn't that good. But I tried telling an 18-year-old that. So things started to go south pretty quick because I started using it for emotional anesthetic. I started to feel kind of afraid. I started to see the future and not really know the future, that fear of the unknown. And alcohol worked perfect. That's when I started like pouring drinks for myself when I got home. Nobody home, and that was the first. I never did that. Go home, mix like a Captain and Coke or whatever we drank, and sit down and start playing video games, And my roommates would come home and be like, "You drinking? Drinking by yourself?" I'd be like, "Yeah, 4-year pass, And in college, it wasn't that big of a deal, but it took quick. It wasn't like this gradual kind of thing over the course of years or anything. It did get worse over time, that's for damn sure. It got worse over time, but it got bad fast. Within a year, I dropped out of college, and I had always been a pretty decent student, but man, that alcohol it solved everything. It solved all this anxiety and fear and anger. I had a lot of anger, and it made it go away for a few hours, and I could pretend like everything was okay, and it actually felt okay. While I was drunk, the right amount of drunk, everything did feel okay. But it was like the more alcohol got a hold of me, the less any kind of future or goals or thought of my or or health, emotional health or anything, that just started to fall away, and alcohol became this huge priority. And so school didn't seem like a big deal to drop out of school. And that was a big shift. So I dropped out, and before long, I was doing things that I really knew I shouldn't be doing. Like my guilty conscience of drinking in the morning alone, hiding drinks, you know, being 21 years old and knowing in my, gosh, man, anybody who drinks like that's an alcoholic, right? You got an issue. And that makes you want to, made me want to drink more, just to drown it out. Just be like, you should not be doing that. Fuck it. Drink, you know, drown it out. And so the guilt and the shame and the thing, it just made me drink more. I wish I would have tapped out and just really confessed. I think what I really needed when I was 21, 22 was a good counselor, like early on, somebody I could really be honest with. You know, they talk about the lack of the ability to be honest being like the main obstacle to recovery. Anybody can, if you don't have that ability to be honest, you're going to have problems because those secrets just make us want to get escape. You know, and how are you going to escape? You're going to find a way to escape. It might be through pornography or through food or through sex or through alcohol is my thing. But you're going to find a way to escape if you have that guilty conscience. And I just couldn't, I just didn't feel safe to be honest with anyone. And so the addiction just took control. And it was a wild few years, tragedy after tragedy after tragedy. And when I say that, I usually mean family, letting my family down. Devastating my family, you know, to see me go from a pretty decent guy, kind of with my stuff together, to falling off a cliff and doing these horrible things. And they were really the object of my anger and my, you know, I blamed them for a lot of things. Get off my back, stop micromanaging me, you drink too, how dare you, you know, you drank it every Christmas. I can remember ruining a Easter brunch. Because I was sloshed at Easter brunch at like age 20 and getting into a political debate with my uncle, drunk as hell. And I was going to the bathroom and sneaking drinks so I could like pound a few and then go out and drink mimosas like I was just tasting it, right? But I'd, you know, sneak in, pound three, and then go come back out and talk politics with my uncles who are ridiculously smart attorneys. But I was emotional, right? And I made a real ass of myself at this thing. It was embarrassing. But that was just one of many events that my family were just burying their heads in the sand. What is going on with him? And I went to my first AA meeting after a huge drinking binge, and I did not want to be there. I was DTing. You know, I had 5 days of shutting myself off in a hotel room, escaping from the world and just having case after case after case of beer. And when it finally ended, my dad picked me up and he took me to an AA meeting, which was terrifying. And I was insane. You know, I was shaking and I was red. I had been really sunburned. And it was in a small meeting in Folsom, California, up near Sacramento, which is where I grew up. And they were really nice to me. They were really nice to me. There was only 5 of us in this little circle. And my mom and dad, too, sat with me to, I think, make sure I didn't run or something. And I was just sitting there shaking. And everyone was sharing, you know, saying, hey, and healthy-looking people saying, you know, just like you guys, hey, I'm Ben, I'm an alcoholic. Just matter of fact, you know. And I said, you know, I share it. I said, hi, I'm Ben. I just introduced myself. I didn't introduce myself as an alcoholic. Because I wasn't there. I wasn't there yet. And here I had shut myself off for 5 days in this hotel and just drank into oblivion, into oblivion, into oblivion. Couldn't admit I was an alcoholic. And it wasn't long after that I went to rehab and got introduced to the steps. Now, step one, even now, I feel like is the most important step to my sobriety. It's the most important step to my serenity, I think. It's when I start to feel like maybe I'm not an alcoholic that the world comes crashing in, that my insanity comes back. So, but it took a lot of beat down for me to take step one. You know, for me to just say I'm an alcoholic, to know in my bone marrow that I'm an alcoholic, and that there's nothing wrong with that. It's okay to be an alcoholic. Like, I'm not a bad person. I don't have a bad heart. I don't have, you know, I'm not a, you know, the devil or anything. I just am an alcoholic. I can't drink. When I drink, I can't quit. You know, if I have one, it makes me, I just, it like pulls the brakes off, and I get excited, and I go, screw it, we'll get a bottle, you know, and then we'll just go missing and just get hammered. I have no off button, and I've tried that experiment over and over and over and over again, trying to be a normie, trying to act like I wasn't an alcoholic, and it never, ever worked. I might have gotten away with it once or twice, but over any considerable amount of time, it got worse and worse and worse. All trying to drink normally, like a gentleman or whatever. Never worked. So I know I'm an alcoholic. And knowing step one, it gives me all the serenity in the world. You know, of course I need to do step four, right? Because I do have a lot of shame. I did a lot of bad things, a lot of regrettable things that I need to process, and I definitely need to do 8 and 9 and make amends, and I need a regular spiritual practice and do 11, but and be of service and all that stuff. But I, none of it's going to really work for me if I don't do one. For, you know, for my brain, I won't really invest unless I know, like, I can't drink. So I need to find another solution, multiple solutions, but it's not ever going to be alcohol. Alcohol is never going to work for me again. And that was a hard thing to do at 22. And it was not going to happen, really. I got out of rehab. I got introduced to all the steps. I was like, seems a little corny, a little fruity. I'm not into it. So I got healthy, which is not too hard if they're watching you for 30 days, 24/7. So I did great rehab, man. I shared. I was like, yeah, I was healing. I figured it out, right? And then, yeah, I just knew it all. It was my arrogance is just when I look back at some of my, the way I thought back then, the way I talked, that it was just ridiculous. I was an expert, which I really try to keep myself in check and not be an expert about anything now. And I fall back in. My ego, I was listening to a speaker the other day who was talking about once a person gets healthy, it's like the ego grows back like a, it wants to grow back like a tumor or something. It's like, you know, I'm desperate and willing, and, you know, because I just came off of a gnarly bender, got out of jail, so I'll do anything. Sure, anything. Sober living, be of service, anything you need. 3 AA meetings a day. I'm humble. I'm ready. I'm willing. And then I get, like, some meals and some good night's sleep, and then I start to get picky. I start to get picky and choosy. I don't know about four. You know, I don't know about this inventory thing. That seems a little, or just parts of it, just the big ones, right? But I'll be picky and choosy about what I put down. And some of those amends, they don't even know me. You know, I couldn't even find them anyway. So there's no reason to even put it down on my 8-step list. No one knows I did it. My sponsor doesn't know I did it. I couldn't find them, so why even put it down, right? I'm getting picky and choosy about what's up in my brain. So the rule with, you know, my most recent sponsor, I just recently switched sponsors after 4 years, and he's a great guy and really, really taught me the big thing well, but I felt like it was time to go a different way. But he always says, never leave anything out on purpose. Just don't leave anything out on purpose. If it comes in your mind, write it down. If it comes in your mind, write it down. That's it. You know, it doesn't mean I'll make amends to every single person that's there, but that's 9. We're doing 8. 8 is made a list of people at harm. Make the list. We'll see what happens with 9. You're not on 9 yet. So that's what I tell my sponsees, and that's what I try to remember myself when I'm doing step 10, you know, on a daily basis, because I mess up all the time. And I try to be a little more gentle with myself. I'm not one of these guys that, like, that leads a perfect life at all, you know? I mean, I think in AA sometimes there can be pressure to say, I'm sober, so I'm wonderful, and I never make mistakes ever, and I'm a spiritual, you know, because I don't drink. Not me. No, I make mistakes all the time. All the time I make mistakes. My best self shows up sometimes, you know, and that's usually when I'm praying, I'm meditating, I'm going to meetings, my ego's in check, I'm humble, I'm taking care of my body too, I'm being kind, and then my best self will show up. And then frequently I'll fall, you know, I'll fall out of balance because I work a lot. I'll fall out of balance and then I'll be a little edgy or I'll be a little in fear, you know. If that went too far, then I would drink again, you know. If I really neglected myself, my spiritual program, my body, my relationships, if I let my ego just take me under control, I would drink again, of course. I wouldn't be able to take it. My conscience wouldn't be able to handle it. And that's my anesthetic of choice is, Captain Morgan. So instead, I got to find different ways to like handle my stress and anxiety. My stress, my anxiety, just being in life, you know, I'm going to have pain. But I like the Buddhist kind of viewpoint where they really believe that we're going to have pain in life, you know. And I know I'm going to have pain. I think part of my alcoholism was I never want to feel pain. I want every waking moment to be pain-free, you know. And paradoxically, it made my life a living hell. It made every second that I wasn't drunk miserable, terrifying, you know, so much fear that something bad would happen and I would almost run to go get a drink because I couldn't handle life, you know. But we're going to have pain in life. I know I'm going to have pain. I'm going to have physical pain. I'm going to have emotional pain, you know. But then there's all this extra suffering that comes on that's not necessary, you know, that's not part of being, you know, that comes from my brain. It comes from all the excess pain of with the future and the fear and all this stuff, what's going to happen? Am I going to have a job? Am I going to be able to provide for my baby? Is that, you know, am I going to get fired? You know, all this stuff that is not necessary. And that's me trying to run the show. That's me trying to control all this stuff that I cannot control. There's no possible way I can control that stuff. I love the Serenity Prayer in the version where they kind of mix it up a little bit, where it says, God, grant me the wisdom to know the difference between the things I can change and the things that I can't, and then the courage to change the things that I can't. I want wisdom to know the difference between things I have control over and things I don't, because I'm wasting my energy and I'll make myself insane if I'm trying to control things I can't control. And I do it all the time. I want to change someone's behavior, someone else that has their own like free will, change their behavior, that'll drive me insane, you know, if they're acting not okay. It's a big source of my stress when I'm not spiritually fit. But anyhow, so my running from the time I got out of rehab, I got a few months clean and sober just on ego and momentum, I think, and that was in Santa Cruz, California. When I turned 23 in rehab, and I got my intro to the steps, liked some of them, got out, was really felt like there was no way I could ever take another drink because I had so much knowledge about my condition, you know, that it was impossible, it wouldn't happen, it couldn't happen. And so missing a meeting was not a big deal, you know, it was like, I can miss a meeting, I would never take another drink, but the anxiety started up. Right, and so I did the next indicated thing, which was Xanax, right? Because I was feeling anxious, and Xanax is meant to treat anxiety, so it made sense to take the Xanax because I legitimately had anxiety because I hadn't been going to meetings, and so I took the Xanax and whoo, work, okay, all right, feeling better, right? Of course, yeah, you take Xanax, you'll feel better in about 10 minutes because it's alcohol. Is really what it is on the brain. Benzodiazepines and alcohol are almost identical in our brain, and they're the only two drugs that we can die from in the detox. They're so physically addictive. The only two that can kill us are benzodiazepines like Xanax, Klonopin, Ativan, Librium, Valium. Those are benzos. And alcohol, those are the only two that can kill us because they're so similar. So I went for the Xanax, and then the guard's down. And am I sober anymore? I don't know. Have you guys, I've had relapses before where I didn't tell anyone because I don't know. I don't really think, that wasn't a relapse, right? No need to tell anyone that. Keep that. Yeah, I chugged the whole thing of cough syrup, but I was pretty sick, you know. Those kind of gray areas where you're like, I definitely liked the feeling, but I'll keep that to myself. And so that plays on the conscience. You know, I'm sharing, I kind of feel like a fraud when I'm in a meeting, and then so I don't want to go, and then it just goes from there. I've been in and out of the room so many times. It's crazy. I'll go in after I'm scared and terrified and willing, and then I'll go out as soon as I'm comfortable or whatever. And then the pain will always drive me back in. And the people or the fellowship or the program or the steps or the work, right, will drive me out. And I did that dance for 5 or 6 years. And it always got worse. The drinking and using always got worse every time. So what happened, I was out for a few months, started with the Xanax, and then started abusing the Xanax shortly. Within a week, I started taking more than was prescribed, and then started hanging out with people that I had met in rehab that had relapsed. Bad idea. Those relationships in rehab are great if you guys stay, if we stay sober, then we can be like, not, we have a bond, you know? But if they relapse, then all of a sudden you're like using buddies, drinking buddies. You know you can like crash and burn together. And that's kind of what happened. I started hanging out with this girl I met in rehab. And that's when I took like my drinking and using to another level. I remember it was, because the Xanax, there was some like justification in there, but there was no justification for alcohol. I mean, I knew I could not drink. I should not drink. And so that Corona in the bathroom at that party was, I was like, here it goes. All right, here we go. And that's, it kind of feels like going on a roller coaster and you don't know if it's broken or not, or if it's, or if you're going to live or how it's going to go, or parachuting. You're not really sure about the parachute. So, all right, here goes the Corona, and just off like a rocket, you know, hiding drinks immediately, making excuses at work. Everything was, you know, I got hit by a car, I crashed, I couldn't come in and let you know, stealing from work. I was doing all this stuff around using within, you know, a very short period of time. And I started smoking methamphetamine during that time too. Drugs, alcohol. I'm one of those lucky people that can go to NA or AA and feel totally at home, because anything that feels good or that got me high was really bad. I think alcohol took me down the fastest, probably. Alcohol would take me down, towards the end, it would take me down within a week. I couldn't keep a job. And I'd be drinking in the morning. You know, I'd have a few months sober, I'd take a drink, and within a week I was doing morning drinking, trying to hide it during the day, doing the breath mints, cologne, doing that whole thing. But moving here to Santa Barbara, God, time flies. Moving here to Santa Barbara, it was just a total mess of a life. And my parents had gone to Al-Anon enough to set boundaries with me that where they knew they couldn't get me sober. You know, it tortured and killed them. I mean, my mom tried with every fiber of her body to solve my problems. She wanted me to move in. She wanted me to stay away. She tried being furious with me. She tried begging and crying. She gave me money. She wouldn't give me money. She like didn't know what to do, because the natural thing for a mom is to go take care of her kid. She wants to take care of me. But I was so insidious, and the disease, I was like, it was like Satan was in my body. And I would lie and be so self-serving and selfish. So my parents over the years finally learned like how to set boundaries, which was like, we're not giving you money at all. You're not welcome here. If you need help to get into a treatment center, then we can talk. If it has to do with you dealing with your addiction, then we can talk. But we're not going to pretend like you're not sick. So it was like infuriating. I was really offended. How dare you? You know, kind of a thing with this self-righteousness. But it really helped me get sober quicker. Those boundaries that they set really, because it was by pretending like I didn't have a problem, it kind of enabled the problem to keep going on. But spending a couple Christmases by myself, because I wasn't welcome there, because I wouldn't take step one. It's lonely, you know, waking up and drinking on Christmas morning, knowing you have this beautiful family that's all together and they don't want you there. Why? Because they're all jerks? Or do I have a problem? Right? That's what boundaries do. It's like a mirror that really helped. It helped me. It was hard. I hated them for it. But then I was able to get recovery. And I had an overdose shortly after I moved to Santa Barbara. Alcohol was kind of like on its way out. I had a couple bad drinking binges when I got there. And then I had an overdose. And when I got out, I moved into sober living there. And I stayed in sober living for 2 years. For 2 years. And how many people here have been in sober living? A lot of people? A few? Yeah. And I actually work at a sober living now, too. And I enjoy it. And it was everything. I mean, it was fun. There was a lot of camaraderie. There was craziness and chaos. The first week that I was in sober living, my roommate robbed a bank. And the Wells Fargo that was up by Cottage Hospital, this guy had issues. Check this out. So I was there for the first week, just out of the 5 East, out of the hospital detox, and just fragile, like a raw nerve. You know, no drugs or alcohol, all these people I didn't know, kind of rough around the edges, didn't know anyone in Santa Barbara. It was not comfortable. And then the freaking feds raid our house, and they're looking for this guy who the night before was sharing about how he was really broke and that he was kind of depressed and needed a job. Okay, so he got real depressed or desperate or something, because he went into the bank up there, robbed the bank with a note. Then the dye packs went off in his bag. I think he got like 20 grand or something, and the dye packs went off in his bag, stained all the money. And I lived on Haley Street, the lighthouse that was right next to the laundromat. He took the money over and ran the money through the washing machines and tried to clean the money. It did not work, of course. He also robbed the bank with a piece of mail that had our address on it. Yeah. So the cops got the note, and they just came to our house and just arrested him. So we're like, oh, shit. Like, what? Okay. But there was, living in sober living, you're dealing with a lot of people who don't have, you know, that drugs and alcohol are there. I know, like, our house manager was like, he needs to go to jail for just being stupid. Like his crime is, like, no IQ, you know, to try to rob a bank like that. But that was, like, my first week. We had that. There's chaos in there. There's a, you know, you got a lot of people that are trying to start life without their main tool, which is drugs and alcohol, and learn these new tools, which is really hard. You know, you don't have that alcohol, that drug, and you learn how to show up on time, how to tell the truth, how to do all these things. It's very new and uncomfortable. Telling the truth was hard. I mean, learning how to tell the truth was really difficult for me, because I was so useful to lying about everything. Everything that I talked about was a lie. You know, I didn't know how, I felt like if I was to tell the truth, I'd get in trouble for it. You know, because I was so used to hiding everything. I was so used to doing things I shouldn't be doing that I would lie about things that didn't matter at all. And getting sober has been a crash course in how to live life, you know. And step one is still my favorite step. You know, two and three I felt like I didn't really take until after I started doing my amends, because I had no, you know, came to believe and made a decision about higher power. I was kind of like, I just wasn't spiritually fit at that time. You know, I was just in again, and I was so used to being a failure, I just thought I was going to fail again. I was like, I don't know anything about God. But my sponsor was like, as long as you don't think you are God, or as long as you're willing to seek. And I was like, yeah, I'm willing to seek, you know. And he said, okay, then you're good for two and three. And we started on four. Nothing is too small. That was his thing. Nothing is too small. If it comes into your mind, write it down. So it was long. I mean, I did this one, I did, and it was long. It took us, when we did step five, it took us like 6 or 7 hours, and we did it all in one sitting. Stopped and got coffee. My sponsor started doing like jumping jacks. He's like, God damn, you're thorough, man. And I was like, you told me to be. So I put down every resentment I could ever remember having. And so many of them were just little things, but they were in my brain. I never forgot them, you know what I mean? Like the little kid who hit me in the face when I was probably 6 years old, and other people around laughed. You know, that was there. Clear as day, Josh, that little punk. Punched me right in the face. And that is, yeah. And that went down. Remember that, you know, they just spanned the whole spectrum. And they talk about resentment being like the number one offender, you know. Anger, jealousy, fear, resentment, these toxic things that just make my mind go around, you know. If I see them, I know what I'm going to say. I'm going to say this and that. I'm going to snub them. I won't talk to them. I'm going to hurt them somehow. I'm going to poke them, you know, in some way. And I'm prepared for it. And I'm so distracted by that, it just eats me up. You know, and so clearing out is like a daily thing, but we had to do that huge kitchen cleanup for steps four and five. And after five, I felt good, I think, because I had dumped a lot of baggage, of course. I mean, 6-7 hours worth of my life I had dumped. But also I felt like I was more of a member of AA, you know, that I could share in AA. I could share that I had done my fifth step, that I had legit like written a four step that I felt clear about, that I really tried, and that I had done five, which is not something I'd ever done before. And so I felt like I had more of a seat in AA and I could share about it. And six and seven were, I think that's a lifelong thing for me, you know, becoming entirely ready to have God remove my defects, because they're always coming back up. I have these days where I'm like, God, everything's so good. Everything feels good. Like, I'm not creating any more negative karma. I don't have any resentment. I'm just floating, and things are great. And then other days, I just feel like, God, everything I say is wrong. I can't do anything right. You know, I say one thing wrong, you know, like that kind of thing. So my fear will come in, my anger will come in, my self-righteousness, my ego, it comes in. I'm 8 years sober, and it happens all the time. It totally depends on how much I'm growing, I'm checking myself. Prayer, I swear, prayer and meditation are the opposite of fear and anxiety. When I'm really afraid, I know prayer and meditation take care of it. They wipe it out. And then I feel like my spiritual belly is really full when I've been praying and meditating. I do a lot of different spiritual things, but I feel like clear. And then I'll lay off of it for a while. I'll lay off. I'll be like, I don't need it. I'm like coasting. I feel so good. And then slowly but surely, the fear and the anger and the control comes back in, where life has to be my way. And if it's not my way, I'm going to tense up. That's what I'm going to do. This isn't how it's supposed to be. Like the actor, right, that wants to control the whole show. And that's how it is. But it all has to do with me not knowing the difference between what I can control and what I can't. I just got delusional about it. And so six, becoming entirely ready is, I think that's like a every morning kind of a thing that I should do. If I was smart, I would do that every day and really remind myself in my morning meditation. I get up in the morning before 10 usually and have coffee and sit on the couch and think about my day, you know, what it's going to be like, kind of ease into it. And I think I need to step it up a little more and really remind myself that I'm powerless over, because it, I don't know, makes for a better day. But seven is good too. I think humbly ask them to remove my shortcomings. I could do that on a daily basis too, because they're always coming back up. But life is good. Life in sobriety has been incredible. I mean, I never could have, like, if when I came in and I if they said, you know, in 8 years, what do you think your life could be like? And I wrote it down, it never would have been this good. It would have been like, you know, have a job that has insurance, you know, have a girl that, you know, that likes me, but I don't think I would have been good enough to get married. You know, myself, I don't think so. And that, I think, you know, I didn't have an apartment. That's probably what I would have written down. And I would have just sold myself so short, because life has just blown up. I mean, I got into sobriety and my sponsor told me, I wanted to go back to school. I didn't think I'd ever finish. But my sponsor told me, he's like, just treat it like, because he was in school then too. He said, just treat it like AA. Show up a little bit early, you know, be there early, at least on time, stay a little bit late, get to know the people in your class, go, you know, and do everything that's suggested. You know, do your homework, do your assignments, do your research. Just treat it like AA. You'll be fine. And it was absolutely true, you know. I did my 2-year alcohol and drug counseling credential at City College. And then I finished my bachelor's and I got my master's degree in clinical psych. And that all happened kind of just as a byproduct of 12-step. It was like I was just going to meetings, going to 12-step, going to 12-step, going to 12-step. And the whole time, I basically worked, I went to school, and I did program all the time. That was my life. And it was great, and it continues to be great. I still go to program all the time. I work as an addiction therapist now, which is a trip. And sometimes I'll get from the guys, they'll be like, you don't know what it's like, dude, kind of a thing. I'm like, you got a second? Because I can tell you some snarly stuff. I know what it's like to wake up and to be terrified that the light is coming in through the window, that I have to go out and pretend like I'm normal, that I have to go outside and pretend like I... like take an errand that I don't even need just to be seen out in public. Like, I'm a human being. I'm walking down the street in the middle of the day when I really have nothing to do. I can remember seeing other people that have things to do. They're in a car, they're driving to work, they're on cell phones, they have people to talk to, and just feeling like an alien. Like I wasn't part of life because alcohol had just taken everything from me. I know what it feels like to be spiritually dead, to be spiritually dead to the point that you don't even want to be here. I know what that feels like. The beautiful thing for me, because I didn't think it was possible, was that I could basically get a do-over. You know, I could basically get a do-over in AA. And I had no introduction to God. I had no introduction to spiritual life when I was a kid. My introduction to spiritual life came through 12-step. And it morphs and changes and grows and shrinks, and it is always changing because I'm growing and I'm learning more and I'm reading more and I'm praying more and I'm meditating differently and all these things. But I tell you what, like, the real spiritual feelings started happening after I started making those amends. Those amends that I never felt like I would make, those things that I drank over, that I wanted to make go away, there's a list of them sitting right in front of me. Phone numbers, emails, addresses, ways to reach these people. The only thing that was stopping me was me and my willingness, right? That was the only thing that was stopping me from that really brutally uncomfortable conversation of apology, of a really deep, detailed, just fall at your feet naked and say, this is what I did. I was wrong to do what I did. I'm never going to do that to you, God willing, anybody else ever again. And is there anything I can do to make it right? Just total surrender. The big fight on the amends for me was just the willingness fight. It wasn't the fight of actually doing the amends. It was the deciding if I was going to do it or not. You know, was I going to have the courage to do it or not? Once I got to the point where I was like, I'm doing this. It's happening. I got some relief. You know, and then of course it peaked when I went and actually met with the person. It peaked in this like spiritual buzz, because that's what happens when I don't know how it's going to go and I've let go of control of it. And I have burned some people. And Jen and I took a trip to Santa Cruz to make amends, because I did a lot of dirt in Santa Cruz. And we drove up there and I think we thought I might go to jail. There were some situations where I definitely could. And so we had a little contingency plan in case that happened, but that's part of letting go, is I could go to jail, that's okay. I'd rather be in jail doing the right thing, you know, than be out here making excuses out of fear. No. It's better I just not say something, you know. And everything went great. I just feel this, like, weight off, you know, this huge weight off. Do I need to finish up here?
Yeah.
Ish? All right, I'll wrap it up. The amends were just like a buzz. I mean, and they started to roll. I saw like how, if I was totally honest and just naked about what I had done and really wanted it, I wanted to bridge that. I wanted to create a bridge there where I had burned that bridge. I wanted to create a bridge. How forgiving people were. And I mean, we dropped into some amazing conversations, you know, in those amends. And things, it was incredible. That's when I started to really feel different, was that night step. And I can't really, I guess I could do that. Let me see, what could I do? 10, 11, 12 are great, thank you. Ten is really how free do I want to be kind of a step, you know, because I will create baggage. I try in life. I try hard. I do a lot of things. I interact with a lot of people. There's a lot of opportunities to create baggage. And so if I let it build up and I don't do those 10 steps, I start to carry a lot. You know, I start to carry a lot of fear, resentment, that kind of stuff. The 10th step for me is like I can drop those rocks whenever I want to. You know, if I want to get on the phone and I want to write out a little 10th step, I can get rid of those rocks as I go along. Sometimes I'm better at it than others. 11th step for me has been a regular meditation. And I left it for a while. And I'm really glad that I'm back into my daily meditations, because it works. And it works quickly. I'm getting to the point where I can really drop in quickly to my meditations. And it's really good. And I read spiritual texts. I'm reading a really good book on recovery right now, that's based in Buddhism. And I know I read the big book all the time. I go to 3 big book studies a week. But 11th is real good. And I have, you know, I always have at least 2 sponsees. I have 3 right now that are a pleasure to work with. They go to school where I work. And so I meet up with them and have lunch with them. And I try to, you know, do my best to be a good sponsor and mentor for them. But AA just gave me a totally second chance at life. And if you are new, like I had given up. You have to realize, like, I didn't think I could do it. I had come in and out of AA so many times that I had no confidence in my ability to do it. But I stayed in that sober living house, which I really needed that accountability. And I just took one assignment at a time, one meeting at a time, one suggestion from my sponsor at a time, and I just did it. And once I started to get to around step 9, I started to feel like I might make it, you know. And it's been 8 years, and I know if I don't keep doing it, I'll be in trouble. So I just enjoy having AA be a part of my life, and I hope it always stays that way. Thank you.
Let's give Ben another hand. Thank you. All right, so we passed the basket.